Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. This segment is called Dave's Got Guests, and I do have a terrific and interesting guest who's got a play going on in Los Angeles. And it's kind of odd that we're talking to him for an L.A. play, because he's also had stuff done in Long Island. I think a year ago he had a show at the Arena Playhouse. So should have probably talked to him then, but I'm sure he's going to have more plays on Long Island. Right now, though, he's got a fairly big production going on at Theater 40, I believe it is. It's called Japanese Death Poem, but don't think that this is going to be a sad and somber conversation. I have with me Danny Arcieri, or D.T. Arcieri to you, and he's the author of Japanese Death Poem, and we're going to talk about that on Dave's Gone By. Hey, Danny!
Hi, David. How are you? Thanks for having me here today.
Very, very happy to have you. So, I've always thought, I've seen your name before, and I know that you've had something at Arena, and you were also, did you not at Broad Hollow, but what's the other, Airport House?
There wasn't an airport, I was at Theater 3. Yeah, I did a one act up there a few years back with Jeffrey Sanzel. Mm-hmm. Had a good time, great show. You know, he does terrific work up there.
So, I thought of you as a Long Island playwright, that you were really making a name, and it's kind of rare to, as a playwright from this area. Not so much in Manhattan, and certainly not on the West Coast. So how did that start, and then how did suddenly you get sort of that bi-coastal thing going?
Well, actually, I had work done in the early 90s in New York. That's probably where I made my bones first. Actually, I started university, but you know, was a fluke, really. I was teaching a class, and there was a student in my class who was the president of the theater club, and we just started chatting, and I actually had a one act, and he read it and liked it, and he put it on at Farmingdale State.
Okay.
And I fell in love with theater at that point. And I'd say a few years later, I had a one act done in New York, and that's when the ball really got rolling. As for Long Island, there's just not a lot of opportunity.
Right.
And I would say, on the whole, gutsy guys like Fred DeFay at Arena,
mm-hmm,
and Jeffrey Sanzel at Theater 3, you know, you've got to have a lot of guts to do original work, because it's not going to pay. You know, I don't think the audiences here really want to see it. And, you know, in New York, you're gonna find a lot more new work. And even in New York, they don't want to take risks. You know, they got to pay bills and stuff, so.
What show did you have done in the earlier days when you were, I assume, off Broadway? Where and what?
I did a couple of shows. I worked with Myriad Arts. I did a play called Drinking Zombies, which was later done in Los Angeles, and a play called The Scream at a small venue called the Actors Institute, which was later also done in Los Angeles. I did work with Vital Theater on 42nd
okay.
Street.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had a play called Requiem for Albert produced there. Small stuff, mostly small venues, but excellent. I mean, very tight, great. I mean, you know, size is no indication of quality. These are 99 seat theaters.
That's what I told my wife. Well, how did the LA connection come about?
Well, you know, I'm a member of the Dramatists Guild, and through them, I know about theaters that are, you know, looking for original work. Also, you can go on the internet now. You just plug in, you know, your Google Play submission, and
right,
you
yeah.
can find all kinds of stuff. At any rate, in Los Angeles, I had sent a play of mine called Norman. It was the play that Jeffrey Sanzel did up at Theater 3, and I got a nice letter back from Theater 40, and this is, I guess it was 2001, saying that they had received hundreds and hundreds of scripts, and that they were only producing four shows, and that I was the fifth, that I was number five. It broke my heart. It was horrible. I would rather be 105 or 205, not five. So I had my tail between my legs, and, you know, everybody's saying, oh, well, you know, that's pretty good. But, you know, really, in terms of being a playwright and wanting to get produced, it's categorical. Either you get a show or you don't.
Right.
I
absolutely
might as well be 205. Yeah. But the funny thing was, I rent a studio in Bohemia, and I have a landlord there, who's a friend of mine now, Mr. Ray Lindsay, and he knows nothing about playwriting, and he deals in vintage cars, and I know nothing about cars. So he likes hearing about playwriting, and I like hearing about cars. So we talked to each other, and I went over to his place. Well, actually, I was at my studio, and I was talking to him when I got that rejection. And I told Mr. Lindsay, I said, Mr. Lindsay, I'm number five at this theater. Can you believe it? It's in L.A. And, you know, and he said to me something. He said, Danny, that's what they tell everybody, that they were number five.
Oh, nice yeah. guy.
Well, you know, I actually, it was like I had a revelation for a moment.
No, I'm telling you, as a playwright myself, they don't. Sometimes they send you a form letter.
Oh, no,
and
absolutely.
It says, thank you very much for your play.
I agree. And sometimes they don't even send you a letter. You know, you never hear from them again. But I'll tell you, Mr. Lindsay, he was being frank and his, you know, honest self. And I thought for, you know, oh, my God. You know, he could be right. You know, they could tell everybody. That almost made me feel better because I really didn't want to be number five.
Right.
I didn't want to get that close. At any rate, about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from Los Angeles from Theater 40, and there was a gentleman on the other end of the phone, a guy named Steven, who told me that there had been a change and that the director of the festival was not the director anymore, and that one of the shows that the cast, you know, the theater group didn't like, and they were going to bounce it, and that my show was in. So I was number five. They took me in. It turned out to be Stephen Tobolowsky. I had a long conversation with him, and I didn't know it was him.
Him meaning who the
Stephen Tobolowsky?
What capacity, in other words?
He was one of the. He wanted to direct my show. He wanted to direct it at Theater 40. He was part of the festival. He's not the artistic director of Theater 40, but he liked my play a lot.
And he wanted to bring it to them and direct.
Yes. He looked at it and he said, I want to do this one. And so he called me and told me I was in, and I was very pleased. And at the end of the conversation, you know, he said, you probably know who I am. I'm a character actor, and you've seen me maybe in something. And then he told me what movies he had been in, and I was like, oh my God.
Groundhog Day.
Yeah. Ned Ryerson is usually, you know, from Groundhog Day. Yeah. That's the big one.
Now he's in Deadwood, which I guess would be a bigger profile than...
It might be. I don't know. Groundhog Day is such a classic. That, you know, everyone knows that. But he's been in, you know, I mean, I can name 400 movies. He shows up all the time. Every week I see him in some movie. He plays, you know, small roles, so sometimes you overlook it. You know, Freaky Friday, he had a role in last year. And Garfield, he was a real...
Did anybody see Garfield? Well, you.
I don't know.
Is that why you saw Garfield?
Yeah, actually, I do. I have a son.
Oh, Mitt Mazel. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So, he wanted to direct that show.
Yes, he did direct that show, and he did a wonderful job. And we were colleagues and friends, and I am so pleased that he is willing to, you know, work with me on another project. He came to New York about a year after we did the show in L.A., he came to New York to do a Broadway show, Mornings at 7.
Oh, that was a wonderful revival.
Yes, you saw that. Well, yes. That was him. Julie Haggerty was in that show, and Christopher Lloyd and Buck Henry.
They just did it really
well. It was wonderful. It was a great show. Well, while he was in New York, I'd go in and schmooze with him, you know, and whatever. And I handed him a script. Japanese Death Poem, a new play, and he read it, and boom, you know. That was about 2 years ago, you know, 2.5 years ago. So it's been a long process for
us. These days with plays, and musicals even more, if it's under 5 years.
It's true. Yeah, it might be in the accelerated.
Let's talk a little bit about the play,
sure.
Which hopefully we'll get to see in New York at some point. But
that'd be great.
It will go well, of course. And by the way, when is it running at Theater 40?
It opens April 16th and runs till May 22nd.
April 16th to May 22nd at Theater 40 in L.A.
Yes, correct.
What is it about and how did you come up with...
It's a mysterious process, even to me. I think that people, even inside theater, but definitely outside of theater, people think that you have a lot of control over the creative process. And playwriting is mysterious to me. I understand plays... the plays that I've written only after I've written them. For the most part, many times I'm not sure exactly where I'm going. One thing I do have control over are characters. And they are very clear to me, usually in the beginning, and their voices are very clear to me. I find that what I tend to do is put two people together who don't like each other at all, who have real problems. And what I find is if you put these people together and give them a reason to stay in a room together, the pressure generated between the personalities drives action. It drives the play forward. And I usually follow. You know, I'm not the leader, but I'm following the action. And many times when I write, when I go every day to the studio or the next time I go to the studio, I always think, oh, I wonder what's going to happen next. And I think that's why my plays work, because the audience probably, you know, is thinking the same thing, like, what's going to happen next? And I don't think you can create that. I think if I outlined the work, you know, it would be more artificial. It takes that more natural flow, because there is a spontaneity there. I'm not even sure. I think with Death Poem, when I look back on it, it's probably my most personal play because it addresses issues in my life that were at the point of writing unresolved. One crisis.
You were killed by a Japanese person?
No.
Politically.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I would say for the most part, the leads in my play, at least the male protagonist in my play, is usually me in some form, you know, usually some version of me. Other characters are usually composites of people.
Okay.
Not really whole people. But this person, Nathan, who is the lead character in Japanese Death Poem, he's a poetry professor at a small public college.
Okay. And like certainly farming. Well,
yeah, yeah. I work at a small public college. I'm in the biology department. But, you know, there's just, you know, things have changed a little bit here and there. I'm not saying it's biography. But it's emotionally autobiographical. You know, it's not historically autobiographical.
Well, what is the basic crux of it? I mean, what
I think it's a love triangle, really. It's about two brothers. And Nathan, who's the poetry professor, his wife is seemingly having an affair with Nathan's brother, Jonathan.
Yikes.
And Jonathan is kind of a sleazy MD, you know, has a lot of dough and all kinds of cool stuff. And Nathan is the broke, poor academic. And Jennifer, who's Nathan's wife, seems to be drawn to Jonathan and the money and the slickness, but it's really a question, and I think that's what the play is about. You know, you see the tension between the brothers, but you're not sure where Jennifer is going or who she's going to wind up with or even what her motives are, but then it becomes increasingly clear what's happening. Nathan is unaware at the beginning, and I think we're all unaware, and we slowly watch this love triangle emerge, and then we see clearly why it did. But I think one of the interesting things about the play is the brothers. It's a relationship between the brothers, and I've seen it thematically before in my plays. It's funny, when I look back over plays, I see similar themes emerge, mm-hmm. and the tension between brothers. And I think that good plays exist where the past and present collide. And these brothers had a tremendous past where they had problems as kids. In fact, the play, we go back there in flashback, we see jealousy and the tension between them, and it really hasn't changed a lot. As adults, you know what I mean? The things that go on between them, but now they're at a higher level. Now it has to do with infidelity, and it has to do with much larger issues than stealing somebody's cupcake.
But you well, metaphorically, but yeah.
Yes.
How much of that is autobiographical? Or is that whole, the story? Did you have tensions with your brother, and all the rest of it is just fiction?
No, no.
Or was there actually a love triangle, sort of? Between you and your
no, I mean, none of that is true. None of that is true. I think that when I painted Jennifer, the portrait of her, dramatically, I did use my wife to some degree, because there were tensions in our relationship. It had nothing to do with love triangle or infidelity, but I think very common tensions and issues that I wanted to see on paper. Sandy, my wife, has seen herself on stage a number of times, right. And she's always been very kind about it. because you know, the pictures that I paint are my, you know, distorted right. perception of reality, or at least my unique perception of reality. And so I don't think any of that is true. I think the tension between the brothers has more to do with my view on what's of value and what's not. I think that being a poetry academic to me is much more valuable in this world than being a crappy dermatologist. And, you know, I mean, I just use these guys. I have nothing against dermatologists.
Yeah, I know.
But I'm just saying, when you look at the characters, I think the conflict between them is really speaking about values in this world.
Browning over Botox, basically.
Yes, yes. Very good.
Did you grow up? Long Island, or where did you grow up?
Garden City.
Oh, so you were really
I'm Long Island,
hometown
yeah.
boy,
yeah.
kind of thing. And you got into science? Was that?
I knew pretty early that I would be a biologist. I certainly hoped I would, probably when I was 8 or 9 years old. And I had watched birds and, you know, fooled around in the yard and very much into science. Not the brightest kid, but I think probably the most passionate when it came to nature and things outside, and that drove me to study biology. I went to school at Farmingdale, and then I went to forestry school at Syracuse. I studied wildlife there.
Oh, wow.
I worked as an environmentalist for Suffolk County for a couple of years before I went to Farmingdale, and then I went to Stony Brook for a master's degree. And I think ultimately when I did graduate work, I became less environmental and more human. I studied more human brain function, neurophysiology, and again, I just tripped into theater. I think I've always been a little artsy, you know, but that was just, I mean, I like to write. Mostly mm-hmm. it was technical stuff, and that one act was just a fluke, and, you know.
Well, you had written it before you met the guy.
Yes, I had been. I had written short stories, and I had tried poetry. I was trying to find a medium, and with theater, I did. You know, the dialogue works for me. Dramatic structure works for me. You know, it's very natural for me to express myself that way.
Well, let me ask, now that you have gotten into the writing frame of mind, two questions. First of all, what writers, and they don't just have to be playwrights, influence you or do you admire? And also, what's your routine? How do you, considering that you have a wife, got kids, and a full-time teaching job, and you have to send out your plays and stuff, when do you carve out that time, that schedule, to get the creative stuff done?
The first part of the question, I would say, I think there's lots of playwrights who influence me. But I know there was one play I read at one time where a bomb went off in my head, and that was Chris Durang's Sister Mary Ignatius, Explains It All For You. That blew my mind, and I said, I have to do this. I have to do something like this, and I think I can. But, you know, I mean, I love Nikki Silver. I mean, well, you go back, I mean, Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, all, you know.
No, but you seem to be going for a little bit of the folks who shock with comedy a little bit.
There's definitely, my work is dark comedy. You know, it's always a little sugar, and then there's a lot of medicine that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a pattern. I've never written a straight drama. Japanese death poem, I mean, I was worried about the title. Stephen was more confident than I. You hear a title like Japanese death poem, it's hard to believe it's a comedy. And essentially, it is. It's a very dramatic comedy. It's hard to, I'm not really sure exactly where it fits, but there's lots of humor in it, but there's also, it gets pretty substantial emotionally.
I mean, that goes back to one of my writing teachers back at NYU. In fact, one of the first playwrights was Tad Mozell, who was a major playwright in the 50s and also wrote a lot for television in that period of Playhouse 90 and stuff. And he was saying he won the Pulitzer for All the Way Home, which was an adaptation of Death in the Family, the Wolf play.
Okay.
Wolf memoir, or whatever, a novel. And he was saying that there was no way they could keep the original title because death seemed like a curse.
Yes.
You couldn't put the word death on a marquee because no one would know.
I fooled around with titles. And I think in the world we live in today, especially the last couple of years, I think we accept the darker side of reality. And I think it integrates better with other aspects of life. So I don't think Japanese death poem will do the attendance of my play a disservice. Well, I guess that remains to be seen.
It's 40, 50 years past, and we've had death of a salesman, which
yes, that's true.
All right.
That's
you know?
True. Yeah, that did okay. That did okay. But
your schedule.
I'm a staff biologist at Farmingdale, which means that I work in the laboratory mostly. I do teach adjunct there, but I teach at Suffolk Community also,
mm-hmm.
Adjunct, and in their biology department. What I try to do is write in the morning. Lately, in the last two semesters, my schedule hasn't allowed it as much, but over the last 10 years, if I went into work late, which was quite often, I would write in the morning. And that was fine with me because my schedule would be to the afternoon and evening at university. And I'm not an afternoon writer anyway. I need to get up, caffeinate, and sit down. You know, and that would be my agenda. But in terms of the process, I think it's really important for people who want to write to actually find a space.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing for years in the house, but you know, my wife, my son, the refrigerator, the phone, you know, reality, it's like, it's wild. I'm surprised that I actually was as productive as I was. So what I decided about 5 years ago, I thought, you know, if I'm really serious about this, I need to make a commitment. And I rented a space, it's like a loft above a barn. And I have no phone, I'm not plugged into the internet. People can't believe that, but I need no distraction. I have to just really focus. And it's really beautiful there. And you know, I've set it up in a way that, you know, fosters the feeling. I mean, really, you want to get into that zone.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, do you sit down and force yourself to, or do you suddenly think and then finally some shape comes to you and a conflict comes to you?
I think for the most part, I'm constantly writing at some level in my head. You know, not physically writing, but I'm constantly throwing things around, moving things around, because when I do sit down, it's amazing what can come out. I think if you wait to be in the mood or wait for the muse to, you know, pat you on the head, you're not going to write. I think that the creative process has to be ritualized. You need ritual in terms of space and time. You have to have a place, and you have to have a time, and you have to make a commitment. And even if you're feeling crappy, you have to go there. It's like working out. You have to make a commitment, you know?
Once you slack off, it's so...
So I go there, you know, and I play my music, and I light my candles, and I wait for, you know, something to happen. And for the most part, it's shocking. Something does. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm like, what?
Speed yourself up.
Yep. And not every day. You don't always get in the zone, but it's more often than not you can go to that place. And that, you know, when you go to that place, because even if you only wrote one page, you could write five pages, one page. You know, I usually put in only a couple of hours, but you know you've gone to that place that you need to go when you realize that you've been sitting there much, much longer than you... No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I look at my watch and I think I've been there 20 minutes or half an hour. I've been there 2 hours. Total time
that's
distortion.
That's a lucky day.
Yeah. That's when you know when you're in the zone. And again, it's not a function of quantity. You know, it could be a page, but usually it's good, you know.
Are you, one of my problems is I'll start things and get about 10 or 15 pages in and then just be like, bleh.
Yeah.
Have you started a bunch of plays?
There's a pile of work around that. It just doesn't take on its own momentum. And I think you're right. It's like 10 or 15 pages in. You can't push. In the beginning, you're going to have to do a little pushing, the exposition. You have to push a little bit and figure out a good way to get it going. But it has to take on its own momentum. And, I can't tell you what percentage of the plays I start actually come to fruition. But, yeah, they bog down. I'm in that dilemma right now with the play. And I'm wrestling with it. I'll probably let it go.
You want to talk, or are you one of those like me who...
Oh, I can't really talk about that.
Whisper about a play
in the
creation of it.
No, actually, I have... it hasn't been scheduled yet, but my newest work, there's a theater in New York, Abingdon Theater.
Yes, on 36th, right?
On 36th Street. They're interested in doing a reading of my new work, a play called Mosquitoes and Butterflies. Mm-hmm. They have not scheduled it yet, but I got some great notes from them, and they do, you know, quality work. I saw it their last show a couple weeks ago, and they had the guy who directed the last show won, I think, the Tony twice for direction.
Ooh.
So, you know, it's a small place, but it's quality.
Yeah, no, it's a relatively new place, too.
Yeah,
it's nice. So do you go the contest route? I mean, now you have some level of recognition, or are you still sending them out blind, or do you have an agent?
No, I don't have an agent.
Okay.
I don't have an agent. I haven't really tried that hard, and I don't think it's, you know, I think that if I get one, it'll be because they come to me.
Hmm.
It's like publishing. It's like a lot of things. There are so many writers out there that these people in the industry are inundated, and they can't tell you from anybody else. It's hard for them. But the work is, you know, the work is what will, I think, you know, move me along. If I stand out, and I, you know, a play like Japanese Death Poem should stand out, I would be surprised if it didn't get a lot of attention in L.A. I don't know if it'll be good or bad, but it'll get a lot of attention.
Well, it's directed, we should tell or remind everybody, it's directed by Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yes.
Again, from best known as a character actor. You're seeing him on Deadwood now, and you would know him best either, well, Google his name.
Yes.
It's got a Y on the end. Or go rent
he was in
Hug Day again.
Yeah, he was in Memento.
He was in Memento.
Yeah. Okay. I can name a whole bunch of stuff, but
and also
Julie Haggerty is in the show
from Airplane, of course. I mean,
yeah,
she must be so sick of being referred to as Julie Haggerty from Airplane. But
well, I think that, you know, once you have a standout part like that,
yeah,
it's definitive. She's done hundreds and hundreds of movies. Her work is just wonderful. She is she's really terrific. I did meet her at an informal reading of the play at Stephen's house a little over a year ago, and she's very sweet, and I think that she's going to be excellent. I mean, this particular part, I remember my brother saying when he found out that Julie Haggerty was in the play, he said, oh, my God, she was meant for this. I mean, truly, the role of Jennifer is, you know, So I think she'll do a great job.
Well, I want to wish you best of luck with Japanese Death Poem. It's playing at Theater 40 in Los Angeles from April
16th to May 22nd.
Is there an opening day or is there?
April 16th. There's no previews. It'll, you know, I'll be out there.
But it's a full staging. It's not a staged reading.
It's a full production. Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we had a staged reading at a theater called Kitchen Dog in Dallas last June.
Mm-hmm.
Steven flew in from L.A., I flew in from New York, and we worked with a cast down there. That they liked the play a lot, and they did a wonderful job. And a staged reading is truly valuable to a writer. That's why I'm looking forward to the work at Abington, because if you know, an audience sits through it and will comment on it. It was 100 people who saw it in Dallas, and they stuck around for an hour to discuss the play with me and Steve and the cast. And I took a lot of notes, and we learned a lot about the play. And I did a rewrite. And so
is that tough, though, when you get all those voices and this person saying that, and then...
It is.
You still have to go with your gut.
I have a tendency to get defensive, you know, when I hear a criticism. My first thought is, you know, write your own friggin' play. You know, that's my first thought. But, you know, you sit there, and I could hear 10 things, and I write them all down, and over the next couple of days, usually they filter through some process, and two or three of those things I realize are of value and are of meaning. But Stephen helps me a lot. He's such a bright guy.
Right.
He's helped me a lot.
Well, we've been talking with Danny Arcieri, or if you see him... Oh, yeah, that last question. What's with the professional, quote-unquote, name of D.T.?
Oh, D.T. Arcieri. Yeah. I had decided early on...
You weren't an alcoholic with the D.T.s, right?
No. But I did think I of a group of my 1X being called the D.T.s. Wouldn't that be fun? I tried to sell it to a theater in L.A. They almost bought it. I had decided early when some of the plays I wrote had strong sexual themes that...
Now we're talking.
Yeah, that it would be better if the individuals at the theaters, the artistic directors and the literary managers, did not know if I was a man or a woman.
Oh.
So I tried to obscure my gender because I wanted them to see the piece as it was, not from like, oh, a man said this or, oh, a woman said this. I wanted it to be, I wanted the play to stand on its own without a biased, you know, reading. And it just stuck, and I, you know.
And now that you're identified with it,
yeah, DT people, yeah.
With it, yeah,
yeah.
But it's Danny or DT Arcieri, A R C I E R I. If you're going to the coast, go check out his play, Japanese Death Poem. If you're staying in New York, well, he'll hopefully have a show at the Abington in a few months, and who knows where else. He'll also probably on Long Island as well. Danny, thank you so much for being in the neighborhood.
Thanks, David. I appreciate you having me here today.